There have been many studies as to the safety of genetically modified organisms in our food. Some studies prove the GMO foods are safe. Other studies prove the GMO foods are not safe. And so we ask, who is telling the truth about the safety of GMOs in our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 956th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Now, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Brisbane who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Aaron, I have a question for you.
I have an answer.
Good. Who is telling the truth about the safety of GMOs in our foods? The proponents of GMOs or the opponents of GMOs?
I'd say without a doubt the opponents.
Uh-huh. Got proof?
Well, I think our healthcare has enough to do with it, don't you?
We'll see. Well, folks, there it goes. There have been many studies as to the safety of genetically modified organisms in our food. The studies sponsored by proponents of GMOs tend to say that GMO foods are safe to eat. The studies sponsored by opponents of GMOs, on the other hand, tend to say that GMO foods are not safe to eat. The question of GMO food safety has become an industrial war of truth, with just about everything you can possibly imagine at stake. Now, when I first met Howard Vlieger at a Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance conference in Bastrop, Texas, it did not take me very long to figure out which truth Howard represented. And in fact, when it gets right down to it, it doesn't really take all that long to figure out where most people stand on this issue. Having met Howard and listened to him speak out against GMOs, it didn't surprise me when a study he was associated with crossed my desk entitled, get this now, A Long-Term Toxicology Study on Pigs Fed a Combined Genetically Modified Soy and Maize Diet. That's a mouthful in itself. Now, listen to some of the claims from the study's abstract. The GM diet was associated with gastric and uterine differences in pigs. That means, like, there was a difference in the pigs that ate the GMOs and those that didn't. GM-fed pigs had a higher rate of severe stomach inflammation, with a rate 32% of GM-fed pigs compared to only 12% for non-GM-fed pigs. And the severe stomach inflammation was worse in GM-fed males compared to non-GM-fed males by a factor of 4, and GM-fed females to non-GM-fed females by a factor of 2.2. But, you know, statistics are one thing. When you read an abstract, your eyes go cross-eyed and you fall asleep. But what was the real kicker in this study was that those who made the study took pictures of the stomachs and put them on the website. And you can see this photographic comparison of the stomachs that processed the GM foods and the stomachs that processed the non-GM foods by going to metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com. Go there, look at those photographs, and then consider what you are to hear as follows. Now, given the scientific principles upon which this study was designed and conducted, the credentials of those who conducted the study and the credentials of the peers who reviewed the study, it becomes pretty difficult to dismiss the study's findings as being purely partisan, yet many, of course, do. This from the blog Biotech Now. The study reaches conclusions that are diametrically opposed to the great preponderance of the scientific evidence gathered from hundreds of independent food and feed safety studies that found no difference between animals fed GMO or non-GMO diets. You know, this war of truth between the proponents and opponents of genetically modified foods leads us to ask, who is telling the truth about the safety of GMO foods? So here to help us study the studies, we have Howard Vlieger himself. Howard, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Been a while since we passed the cup around there in Bastrop, Texas. Now, you're an independent crop and livestock nutrition advisor. What the heck does independent mean these days?
Well, I don't officially work for anyone other than myself, I guess would be the way to say that.
That's pretty good. That means independent to me. What is your connection with this pig study, Howard?
I am the primary coordinator and co-author of that study.
So you're pretty tight with it. You're pretty much the one who instigated it, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. We had accumulated the ongoing incidences of the varying health problems connected to livestock when genetically engineered crops were in the ration for the animals, which first began in 1998, is when we had the first problems show up with the farming customers that I was privileged to work with. And, you know, over time it just continued to compile and compile and compile more information and stories and incidences of both conception problems and immune system and digestive problems in the animals, and one thing led to the next, to the next, to the next, and then I was fortunate to get connected with Dr. Carmen, and we put the protocol together and conducted the study.
Okay, I'm going to pick this up, that whole thing, thread up here in a few, but I'd like to ask you a couple questions so that people know where you're coming from here. Now, I know you as an anti-GMO activist and lecturer. Is that fair enough?
Well, I look at myself as an educator. As far as, I'm not anti to the technology. If and when it's utilized and perfected and fine-tuned in the way that they purport it, that they want to use it, mm-hmm. I'm not against technology at all. There are a very limited number of circumstances where the genetic engineering technology is properly implemented and perfected and fine-tuned, and it's beneficial, but it has not been implemented to that point in crop production as of yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the reason I ask, Howard, is because, you know, everybody's looking at your study and saying, hey, that's not a good study because of this reason and that reason. And what I'm trying to get at is that, was it possible for you to design and conduct a study without bias?
Absolutely. And we were fortunate to have input from some of the top researchers in the world as far as the final protocol on the study. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely a blind study. So everything was done as fair and unbiased as it could possibly be conducted.
And who paid for it? Who paid for the study?
There were two sources of funding that came in for payment for the study. One was one of the companies that I founded in 1999, and the other was a foundation from Australia that does research on genetically engineered crops.
Okay, fair enough. So now we know who put the study together and who paid for it. And I'd like the audience to know that I went to great lengths to try to recruit some skeptics of the study. And in fact, I went to three different people who express skepticism and asked them to appear on the show. They did not. They declined to do so. I even had the advertising agency that the biotech industry hires to hold up its technology, and they were looking for somebody to appear on the show, and they couldn't find anybody either. So I've come to the conclusion that the entire biotech industry has taken the weekend off and are staying on some deserted island in the South Pacific without phones. So they're not here to join us, but hopefully they'll pick up their phones and join us today. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson with Howard Vligor, an independent livestock and crop advocate, I guess. The questions we're going to be working with today. Why did Howard Vligor and friends conduct a study of feeding GMOs to pigs when so many studies already exist? Was this pig study designed to be scientifically objective, or was it designed to prove a preconceived notion about GMOs? And what did the study reveal about the long-term consumption of GMO foods on the stomachs of pigs? This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Howard Vligor and you. The phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, or on the forums at metrofarm.com. You can participate. We'd love to hear from skeptics of this study. If they'll find a phone someplace on that Southeast Island and give us a call, we'd love to hear what you don't believe about this study. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
What do you think? Are the GMOs in our food safe to eat? Well, if you log on metrofarm.com and look at the photographs there, comparing the stomachs of pigs. One group of pigs has been fed GMOs, the other has not. Look at the pictures and then listen to this show, because we have to ask that question. Are those GMOs safe? Now, Howard Vligor is an independent consultant in the world of crop and livestock nutrition. He helps farmers and ranchers all over the place feed their crops and their animals. And Howard, what was it that made you say this isn't working?
Well, as I said, we've started to accumulate the evidence of the ill health in varying degrees to the livestock that was consuming ingredients from genetically engineered crops. That started in 1998.
What did you see in the animals? What did you see that made you stop and think that something is not right?
Well, first of all, in 1997, we did our first on-farm research on our farm. The seed company provided the conventional and the BT version of the corn. And we grew them side by side in the test plot like we had done many years for the seed company. They always provided the seed for that plot. And when it was all said and done, the BT corn, we lost money as a result of having it when we looked at all of the costs associated on it, and it yielded less and had a higher harvest moisture, so that meant less money per bushel when it was sold. We also offered some of that to a couple of stock cows, the conventional version in one end of the bunk and the BT in the other end of the bunk. And the cows cleaned up the conventional corn and walked away from the BT, and that's unusual because cows and grain is like kids and candy. They don't leave until the dish is empty. And then we were looking at it objectively instead of euphorically, was maybe be the way others were approaching the whole thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there was a lot of hype involved with how it was going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread and save the farm and what have you. But the livestock operators that segregated the grain in the beginning and there were different problems that started to surface. It was reproductive issues in a sow herd in Nebraska, and then we saw it in South Dakota, and then it was in southwest Iowa, and in varying degrees.
Now, what does that mean, reproductive issues?
Well, the conception rates on the animals would go down. With one particular BT corn, the conception rate dropped from 30 to 70% of what he normally saw when he fed the conventional non-GMO corn. Another operation that had explicit record-keeping and computerized system in place saw when they had the BT corn in their ration for the sows, they had 1.6 pigs per litter less. And the weight of the piglets was smaller when they were born.
Now, these farmers you work with, Howard, they're pretty scientifically oriented by now, aren't they? I mean, they're pretty good measurers and keep trackers, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. We called all these problems circumstantial and coincidental, or I was referring to it that way. And I was working with Dr. Elaine Ingham, who's a very well-known soil microbiologist, PhD, and I shared with her all of these coincidences and circumstances of ill health and what have you. And she said, "No, Howard, you've accumulated substantial amount of anecdotal information. Now take it to the next level, set up the scientific study, and conduct it and see if you can verify what you've been witnessing." Mm-hmm. And that's what brought the study about. And, you know, the subsequent results.
Yeah, but what
found in the study.
What made you turn away from all of the studies who said what you're seeing wasn't there? I mean,
well, first of all, the majority of those studies were never designed to find a problem. I guess the best way to illustrate that was the comment that was made the day our study was published in June of last year. I received a phone call from a very nice lady with the Chicago Tribune. And she asked me for a response to a comment from an individual from a certain biotech organization. And his comment was, "Well, we don't understand why they looked at the stomach and the utera of the pigs when the studies that we've conducted showed no difference between rate of gain and feed conversion when we feed conventional or GMO grain." And that's very typical of exemplifying the type of studies that they have conducted.
Wait, wait a minute. Let me go.
The study in a way to properly analyze and look at all of the things that could possibly go wrong. So it's easy to find a study that finds no fault when you design the study in a manner that it can't find anything wrong. Mm-hmm.
So essentially, industry studies were looking at the meat produced. And saw, for example, here's a ham, and there's no difference between these two hams, so there's no difference. That's that.
In essence, you were
looking at the insides of the
pigs. Have been ignored.
Yeah. So you were looking at you designed a study that looked at the insides of a pig, the stomach and the uterus and whatnot. Correct. I mean.
We had complete autopsies by two very experienced licensed practicing veterinaries. They didn't know who was who or what was what. It was completely blind. And we analyzed all of the organs except the brain of all of the animals that were involved in that study.
So the conventional studies did not look at these things then. They only looked at the meat that the animals produce and said there's no difference between this meat and that meat, so therefore GMOs are safe to eat. That's kind of where they went, right?
Well, you can look at all the supposed studies they claim to have and look at what parameters they examined. You know, why have they not conducted a complete autopsy? Why have they not followed up on the warning signs that have been indicated in some of the blood work? On the short-term studies they've conducted, there's only two long-term studies that I'm aware of that have been conducted. That's the Seralini study and our study. As far as Seralini's was the lifetime of the rat, the conceivable lifetime of the rat, and ours was the perceived lifetime of a pig as a meat animal.
Well, I guess you both share something else in common, and that is both of you have been roundly criticized by the biotech industry for being non-scientific.
Do you know of any study that has found reason for concern or harm relative to feeding a genetically engineered crop to a mammal that hasn't been accused by all of the promoters of genetic engineering?
I don't. But then, I don't know of all of them. I'm stumped here and I'm looking at the complete disparity between the proponents and the opponents. It seems as though, from what I can see, the proponents say that they have hundreds of studies sponsored by the industry, and they all say that GMOs are safe. And then there are people like you who are saying, well, wait a minute, it's not safe. And there are two kinds of studies, and both of them point in the opposite direction. Today we're looking at Howard Vligor's study, asking him if this study is a scientifically valid study. And we're also asking all those biotech people out there hiding in the bushes of Fiji someplace why this study is not scientifically valid. Point us to the reasons why Howard's study is not scientifically valid. I hope it's not scientifically valid, Howard, simply because what you found in your study is really unsettling, given the amount of genetically modified foods that we are consuming today. And just the photograph that you have displayed showing the severe inflammation of a GMO-fed stomach is enough to stop one in one's tracks. Folks, you can see those photographs by going to metrofarm.com, metrofarm.com. They're right there on the front page. Look at those photographs and then come back and let's see if Howard Vligor's study is scientifically valid. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with Howard Vligor, and you right back. Howard Vligor is an independent crop and livestock nutrition advisor. He works with farmers and ranchers throughout the country, telling them how best to feed their crops and their animals. And one thing he came upon was these anomalies with respect to feeding animals and plants and whatnot, genetically modified foods that have been genetically modified. Something wasn't right, he said. And so he pointed out this information to others, and they said, prove it. Put together a scientific study, and document what you see. So he put together a study. But could that study be scientifically valid? The industry says, oh, that's not scientifically valid. So let's ask Howard Vligor how he went about designing a study that he knew would be rejected by the biotech industry. Howard, let's start with the critters. Why did you go with pigs instead of like hamsters or something?
Well, the reason we used pigs because this was what we were seeing and in real life on the farm. There were problems in other livestock as well, but the reason that we chose pigs, number one, their anatomy is the closest to that of a human of any livestock we work with. So the similarities that was a matter of consideration. And as I mentioned, the conception, which we didn't take this to a conception type study, but there was certainly a concern documented in the weight of the utera, which is directly connected to conception. It was ground level. You know, what's happening out here in the real world?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the study was designed. As I said, we saw digestive issues. We saw ileitis, salmonella, bloody bowel, ulcers for the period of 10 plus years. And seeing this in the food supply for the animals and these issues were consistent. The problem would be there. We'd switch the feed. We'd put it back to conventional in varying operations all over the country. And the problem would go away. They put the genetically engineered back in and the problem would come back. And you could mitigate it a lot of times with the use of antibiotics and ionophores and different things in the ration, which has become the commonplace mainstay right. thing for a lot of the producers to do. And, you know, many say, well, if this is true, what the study indicates, then why don't we have an epidemic? Well, look at the use of antibiotics in production, livestock production between 1995 and today, and see what's, you know, ask the question, why have we had to increase the use of antibiotics?
There you
Is
go.
There something wrong with the quality of the feed that's going into the livestock feed supply?
Now, when you went about organizing and designing this study, you worked with some scientists who have fairly good credentials in the fields of human anatomy and animal anatomy as well, correct? Dr. Judy
yes.
Carman, for example.
She's the head scientist on this study. She had a number of colleagues that she works with in Australia. The part of the study, the protocol, that caused me just a little bit of angst at first, but I'm so thankful that Dr. Pustai was adamant about our doing it. When we had the protocol all put together, I started communicating with Dr. Pustai, I'm going to guess in about 2004 to 2005 time period. And he taught me a lot about how the foreign protein aspects of any genetically engineered crop could be very challenging to a mammal that consumes it. And the one thing that he mandated was that we had to weigh these pigs every week. And that was very important, especially in the later stages, because the people that were doing the weighing, they didn't know who was fed what. They just knew they had to weigh the pigs every week. And the pigs were in the same pen all the time. And they knew that the pigs from this pen and this pen would go through this process of getting weighed quicker and with less hassle than the pigs from this pen and this pen. It always took longer to accomplish that weekly weighing. And as soon as those pigs got into kind of a confined area, and we had set up a simple maze to weigh them, as soon as they got into that confined area, they would start fighting and biting and picking on one another.
Hmm.
And the other thing that was noticed about those two pens of pigs was that when they were back in their normal surroundings, they never exhibited a level of contentment like the other two pens did. The pens over here on the one side, they would eat, they would drink, they would lay down, and it seemed like they were happy. But the other two pens, there were always kind of a listlessness there. And the people that, again, they didn't know, the only person that knew what was different from one pen to another was the individual that actually put the feed in the feeder. The people that did the monitoring equipment or the monitoring of the animals were completely blinded as to who was who and what was what.
So this is a genuine double-blind study then?
Yes. So. And because our protocol was set in such a manner that we weren't prepared and we didn't anticipate that change in behavior. But I look at that. And that has to be identified as anecdotal, and it was not mentioned in the paper, which it wasn't allowed. But I look at that anecdotal thing, and I compare it to all the anecdotal problems that we started witnessing already in 1998. And you fast forward to 2013, well, there's 15 years time lapse between first seeing the problems and having scientific documentation of it.
Yeah.
How have we seen the behavior change in the children, the young adults, and even the general populace in our country between 1995 and today?
Holy smokes. Yeah. Okay, let me ask you the big question here. That's a mind-boggler right there. But let me ask you this one that I'm wondering about. How on earth did you get the feed to do the study? Because from what I understand, to get these feeds, you have to sign a license agreement or something like that. And you have to ask permission to study the feeds, don't you?
That's in the first party presentation and situation of the grain from the purchaser of the seed to the individual that sells the grain.
So once the grain's been made into animal feed, then it's free to use then, right?
Once it goes past the, you know, if the person that purchases the seed is forbidden to do any type of research in any way, shape, or form on that genetically engineered crop unless they have the express written consent of the company who holds the patent. And that same person also is putting the monkey on his back for anything and everything that can go wrong, because the language in those contracts firmly places all ill will or responsibility or anything bad that can happen with raising that exactly like they're told to do it according to the terms of the technology agreement. If something goes wrong, they're responsible, not the company that developed this.
Wow.
Fundamentally changed.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to raise the industry's objections to Howard Bligger, the person responsible for this study. Holy smokes, look at the pictures at metrofarm.com and join us when we get back from this break. Well, folks, Howard Bligger says there is a difference between pigs-fed GMO foods and pigs-fed non-GMO foods. Took a picture of the stomachs, and they're on metrofarm.com. Take a look at those photographs. Compare them side by side. What do you think? You think there's a difference? It looks like to me there is a difference. But the industry says the studies were not good. They're faulty. They're not scientifically valid. Wendolyn Jones, who is the Director of Global Policy and Scientific Affairs for DuPont Pioneer, says the paper lacks credibility in opposition to the hundreds of food and feed safety studies conducted on GMOs in the 15 years of practical experience. Howard, what do you say about that?
I'd like to see one of the studies that she's referencing that shows a full autopsy on the animals that were fed non-GMO diets and GMO diets.
Now, somebody told me that there's never been a peer-reviewed study on the safety of GMO foods. Is that true?
Well, the Seralini study was peer-reviewed and published.
Yeah, but I mean, from the industry, all of those industry studies, somebody said that there's none of them have been peer-reviewed. Is that true?
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Okay, good.
Some of them are. A lot of the studies that they'll reference were never published. But, for example, the Seralini study again.
Mm-hmm.
There's four studies that were done that were similar to his study, but much shorter in the time frame that they were conducted. They never went for more than 90 days, and the specific parameters in blood measurements that they saw definite reason for concern, they just says, well, that doesn't mean anything. It's safe, and said that the regulatory agency should approve that. And even though Seralini followed the same guidelines that they did and only expanded it on the scope of time and added in one other component with basically the same protocol that they used, then he did everything wrong according to them, when in essence all he did was replicate what they had previously done with more specificity and did it for a 24-month time period instead of a 3-month time period.
Now, when you did your pig study, you did the lifespan, correct? The commercial lifespan of the pig, which, what, 22 months?
Yes. What would
happen if you had gone like 5 years and fed the pigs for 5 years? You'd just be speculating, but I guess that's what I was doing. I'm speculating. Well, this from David Tribe, the GMO pundit. Some of the study's observations might be attributed to compositional differences in the variety of soybeans and corn fed to the pigs.
That's true that could be an issue. But the processes in which the feeds were made were identical as far as how the grain was processed into the feed. Mm-hmm. So there was no difference there. And, you know, what we did in that study was actually, in essence, mimicking what we had seen at ground level in real-life situations and circumstances. We had the only foreseeable variable was this is GM, this isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was it the exact genotypes? No, because of restrictions in the language of the contracts of the genetically engineered seed, that wasn't possible. Along that line, you know, you look at back to the Seralini study, he had the Roundup Ready version of the NK603 and the conventional original isoline of the NK603. The one study that was conducted by Dr. Hammond that proved the supposed safety of the NK603, they didn't even use the isogenic conventional version of the NK603. So how accurate was that industry study?
Okay, and this from Dr. Robert Friendship, who's a swine expert up at the University of Guelph. He says it was incorrect for the research to conclude that one group had more stomach inflammation than the other group because the researchers did not examine stomach inflammation. That makes
sense. Yeah, that was an interesting comment. And I had the good fortune of working for a veterinary part-time for 8-plus years when I got out of high school. And I have a number of very good veterinary colleagues that I work with in today, all in different parts of the country in animal health. And I called one of my colleague friends, Dr. Dunham, in Northeast Iowa, after I heard that comment that, you know, there was no way we could identify irritation and inflammation just by visual inspection on those stomachs. And I asked Dr. Dunham, I says, do you have your microscope in your pickup today? And he says, no, we're not doing any semen testing, so I don't need it. Because that's the only reason he carries it with him. And I says, well, according to this individual, the one comment he made, he says, it's impossible to identify irritation and inflammation in the stomach just on a visual inspection. And Dr. Dunham laughed for the better part of a minute. He said, who made that stupid remark that you can't use visual inspection to determine what's wrong with an animal when you're a veterinary?
If you look at the photographs that you posted and that are posted at metrofarm.com, there they are side by side. And if you can't see the inflammation in the one and the non-inflammation in the other, then you must be blind because it's so readily apparent. Well, that's the question. What is real and what is not? So when we come back from the last break, we have just a couple minutes, but I do want to ask our guest what on earth this means for you and I, this GMO food. Is it safe or is it not? Right back. Who is telling the truth about the GMOs in our food? Is it the proponents of GMO foods with their hundreds and maybe even thousands of studies saying that GMOs are safe? Or is it the few, very few people who are standing up saying, opposing GMOs and saying, no, our studies say that GMOs are not safe? Who is telling the truth? What do you think? We asked all kinds of proponents of GMOs to join us today to refute Howard Vligor's study on the long-term effects of feeding pigs GMO corn and soy, and what he saw in those studies. Howard, did the evidence of what you saw in your study confirm the observations you made over the years working with animals out there in farm country?
I definitely believe that it did. We saw a variety of digestive issues, and we saw a host of different reproductive and conception type issues with varying types of BT corn. Everything from less pigs per litter, smaller pigs per litter, to 30 to 70% reduced conception rates, to in some cases pseudo-pregnancies where there were no pigs whatsoever on that particular event of BT corn that was being fed. Well, you know, is the utera an important body part relative to reproduction? So you could say, yeah, there's reason for concern there. If we had anticipated that specific finding, we would have retained all of those utera for further histology analysis. But as I said, this was a double-blind study, so 2 days after the autopsies, or more days, I don't remember how many days, but however many days after the autopsies were completed and all of the numbers were analyzed and looked at, well, then that statistic showed up. Well, the stomach issues, same thing. Is the stomach a key factor in digestion? We saw ileitis, salmonella, bloody bowel, and ulcers in the varying problems that we would see in the digestion, or in the pigs that were fed the genetically engineered grain over a period of 10 plus years. So is the stomach directly connected to digestive issues? So when you look at those conception issues and the digestive issues, I definitely think we indicated a reason for significant concern, and absolutely more research needs to be conducted, and conducted in a manner that will look for the problem that is glaring to a lot of people out here that are able to identify.
How can we do that, Howard? How can we get objective research in a non-objective world?
That's a good question.
How can we get real answers to real questions in a world where nobody wants us to have the real information? Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Howard Vlieger. Please do go to metrofarm.com. Take a look at those comparison photographs of a stomach-fed GMOs and a stomach-fed non-GMOs, and tell me what you think. Howard, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all out there for tuning in the Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you all. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.